And good evening. It is Intuitive Soul Radio with your host, Lori Houston. And tonight, well, this is always a pleasure. We have Jeff Brown with us. And I guess, you know, it's been well over about a year and a half that before I met Jeff, and we did an interview on his book, Soul Shaping, and have done a few interviews since about certain topics and different things that have been going on with Jeff's life since he wrote the book. And today we're going to talk about, I think, a topic that we both feel is incredibly important for these times, but we're going to talk about shame. So welcome, Jeff.
Hey, Lori. Great to be here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Here. Yeah.
Here we are.
You know, you're way over, so far away, and yet you didn't make it to the studio, but you know, that's okay.
Yeah.
So.
You can't shame me about not showing up at the studio.
Really? It won't work?
See how fast that happens?
Bad on me.
There, you did it to yourself now. It really is quite insidious, this shame thing, isn't it?
I think it is.
I think it's way more insidious than we even have begun to understand yet.
You know, I agree. I think it somehow infiltrates our, you know, our human psyche to a point where we just don't see the imprints.
Yeah, you know, it's true. Just to get personal, I've had this kind of ongoing issue with my mother over the last number of months and her economic reality. And so last week we just kind of had this interaction, and, you know, I put up a really firm boundary around my willingness to help her, you know, to help her to a point, but not to the point that she wanted me to. And it was really fascinating. Like, I had this afternoon last week when I got to really spend time with the shame that I knew so deeply, you know, in my early life, something that comes in and out of my consciousness, but I don't get drenched in it so much anymore, not so much. And it was fantastic in a way to just kind of be in this horrible feeling, to try to put language to it and to understand the textures and the contours of it. And it was like this sense that I had that I just was not welcome on the planet, you know. Mm-hmm. So despite everything that I've achieved and everything that's happening around soul shaping, just a little bit of contact with, you know, my mom was really the person who really gave me the zeitgeist of the shame in the family more than anyone did, was all it took for me to kind of plummet right back into those feelings that I really wasn't entitled or something to be in human form on this planet at this time. And It just showed me, I mean, not that I've ever thought that my monsters had all gone away, but it really showed me, like, right up in front of my, right, so visibly and so obviously, just how deep this goes. The roots of shame in this collective unconscious are so bloody deep. And, I think it's under-discussed in the therapeutic movement, and I think we need to talk about it a lot more.
Yeah, I think it's under-discussed because we really just glaze over it. We really don't understand just how much we use it on ourselves, on others, and how much we fear it.
Well, you know, I think part of the problem, I was thinking about it today, it's like we kind of talk about fear, we talk about abandonment, we talk, you know, about guilt, we talk about anger. I feel like we don't talk as much about shame because many of us never really know a state outside of it. So that we actually have not reached the stage developmentally in the culture where we know not shame, where we know empowerment, where we really know what it means to be sacred dynamite, to know our sacred purpose, to know and to honor our magnificence, so that we can then look back and go, whoa, that feeling that I then have of feeling unworthy is not the only feeling available to me. I really feel as though, on some level, almost everyone is carrying this kind of shame negativity about who they are, exposing themselves, repressing their personality so people don't notice. I mean, I just think we've all got it so deep that we don't even know anything other.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think it's really that prevalent and that deep that, I agree.
Like, what would we look like, you know, like physically look like? And, you know, this is the kind of stuff that I think Jean Houston was writing about with Possibly Human and all the work she's done in the world, to just try to imagine or envision, you know, what would a human being look like who really didn't have shame, really carried forward a profound belief in their own value and magnificence, not in a narcissistic way, but just in a way that was really rooted in the power that lives within us inherently. And, you know, how would we walk? How would we sit? How would we talk? How? What would motivate us in our day? What kind of magnificent creations would emanate from our pores, you know? I felt like when I was getting on the back room wall of the house and writing some of Soul Shaping on that back room wall, I was tapping in a little bit into what it felt like to be like in that power where I didn't feel obstructed on the river of essence by this sort of self-doubt trip. And, you know, I mean, I only glimpsed it sometimes. You know, it was like getting liberated from the egoic or the shaming ties that bind, just a little here and there. But it's just, what a fantastic feeling. And I could feel even in that how many more levels were available to me as a human, you know, if I could just keep going and get completely out of the shame trip altogether.
And I guess, you know, that's kind of what we see in children, you know, when they're really young and they can walk, you know, that place when they, you know, first discover themselves and they first learn how to walk and they first, you know, are so excited about everything.
Yeah. 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 That's right. Yeah. I mean, I wonder even then if we fully, you know, children are still born in an environment that, you know, and can feel the constrictions of the environment and the, you know, the lowest common denominator thing starts to happen. But absolutely, it's like when the kid comes running in the room full of excitement about something they've created, you know, where does that go? You know, and I guess really to be of some use to the listeners, like, you know, what do we have to do as adults to try to get back to that purity of presence and expression? And you know, what are the stages that we have to go through? And, you know, I think that's something that's really worth talking about.
Yeah.
How do we get back to that? You know, as adults, not in the same way, obviously savvier and more boundaried and, you know, and all that developmentally at a different stage, but still really feeling into the sense of wonder, not just outside of ourselves, but inside of ourselves too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what would that take? What would that look like?
Yeah, I was thinking about it today. You know, I mean, I think the therapeutic revolution is so important. I mean, I think therapists need to start talking more about this, you know, and need to start working more on it in their own work, in their own bodies, in their own lives as well, so that they can be tour guides for the whole shame trip. And so I think the therapeutic work is incredibly important, like really getting into the body and getting, because it's in the body. And
right.
It's not just a concept, but really getting into the guts of our being and trying to remember in the emotional body and bring forth and work through where we internalized and received those messages, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like for me, it was so frequent. I would walk into my mother's room. My two brothers would be on the bed. She would convey the message, you know, don't be like your brother, you know? It was like to go back into, and I've done some of that in therapy, but probably not enough, to go right back into those old feelings, really churn them up and, you know, and start to sort of resist it, like, you know, push forth or express the anger or the tears or grief below the surface at receiving the message from a parent, you know, that you weren't welcome in your own body on this planet at this time, you know?
Yeah.
Like, do the deep, gut-wrenching work, you know?
Yeah.
I did a lot of mirror work around shame in this, my therapeutic work, you know? Like, I would, like, really look in the mirror. I did a lot of this with different personas or aspects of myself to try to get to the authentic one, but I also would just kind of look at myself and try to feel into myself as shame being and try to imagine what expression I would manifest if I was actually feeling empowered and worthy of life and worthy of love. And so that's another thing that I think I would encourage people to do.
Yeah, because we've all kind of done the bigger ones, you know, the ones where we feel shame about our sexuality mm-hmm. with regards to, you know, if we were raped or something happened to us. But, you know, the smaller things that we don't, like, these are things, like the big things we get, right? But the smaller things, the things that are probably the things that were pushed on us from a very, very young age, those are the things we don't really think about.
Yeah, like just when you would walk in the room and your parent would, you know, frequently say anything. You know, a woman was talking to me about this the other day. You know, I don't like it when you wear your hair down, for example. you know, and just like whatever, like how does that get internalized in the being? How do you carry that forward, you know, when you're not getting the fundamental validation that you need from the parent at an early stage in your development, you know? Mm-hmm. Where does that go inside? You know, absolutely. I mean, I think it is incredibly, it's just so prevalent and so subtle at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there are what were originally being called shame circles, what are now being called truth circles and other names for them, being formed around soul shaping, being formed around people who support soul shaping and, you know, through Facebook and in various groups that have been, you know, I've written a blog about it on my website and written some emails about it on to the group on Soul Shaping Group on Facebook. And, you know, I think one of the most important things people can do is gather in a group. You know, self-revealing, self-exposure, you know, I found this out with the book, is so empowering for people. And so when people gather together and start talking about the things that they're hiding, you know, they're hiding their light under a bushel of shame. And they start revealing things. We all know this. Like, you start revealing some horrifying secret that you've carried throughout your life, and you start talking about it, and then you find out that, in fact, you know, other people have experienced it, and suddenly it loses some of its power,
mm-hmm.
you know? I think group formations are really, really important in that way. You know, I'm calling it now the Valid Nation. So people can gather together and validate one another in their experience.
Right.
You know? Really, so, and start doing the work inside. You know, when I grew up, the fundamental feeling I had was that there was, like, no welcome mat at the door. Like, almost literally. You know, so it's like bringing it back and going, okay, that's the message that I got, but I'm not going to change all of it. I'm not going to go back, and my mother's not going to validate me. That's not going to happen. So it's kind of getting that part of it is this interactive work with other people who are more inclined to validate you, the Valid Nation. And then also doing this kind of clearing the debris emotional work, understanding that the welcome mat starts within. The welcome mat starts within, and, you know, and focusing on that more individual level as well.
Yeah, and I think, you know, understanding how groups can work and feeling valid, it certainly goes a long way. And, you know, that's the one thing about your book that probably, you know, is so different from many people's, is that you were so incredibly open and so truthful about your own experiences to help you understand them. And whether when you initially wrote this, it was, you know, for yourself or for the world, it certainly, you know, has been your journey. And I think a lot of people, you know, appreciate your openness because, let's face it, in this world, you know, you talked about the children that come in. I mean, we have the collective unconscious that, you know, we have to deal with. And then we're brought into a community and we're brought into a family. And so there's all of these aspects that we have to work through. But when it comes to men are not taught to be open. Women can, you know, share a little bit more about themselves and it sort of is okay, but for men, that's an area that's pretty taboo. And for you to have, you know, opened that door in such a way that it's very honoring and it's very refreshing for a lot of women to read that book.
Yeah, I mean, men read the book. You know, there are there's some percentage of men, but small percentage. But mostly, it is women who I think have, you know, kind of been waiting. In many cases, I mean, based on the feedback that I get for men in their lives to reveal what's going on inside. And mm-hmm. so then they encounter a book in the self-help area that is so transparent, you know, and self-revealing. And I think there's something can be something very healing about that, you know, because at least it shows that it's possible.
Yeah.
You know, and not to give the book or me too much credit, but I am really getting it now, that whatever that is in me that says your calling is to do this transparent work and keep talking about your own experience and keep talking about your affinity for oat fudge bars and keep talking about the crazy mother and keep that really this is what we need to all do.
Yeah,
that's it. We just need to all. I remember when I went to see Sean Korn before I knew her and went to do a yoga class with her and. she kept talking about like her OCD and she's OCD and all these hysterical stories. And I thought, what are you telling these people, everyone, about your being OCD, you know? And of course, I was writing a book about my own madness, my own Mishigas, you know, here we are. And it was like, at first, I remember feeling like, whoa, you know, like, shouldn't you keep that dark stuff a secret, you know? And then after a while, I melted into it, you know, in the class. And I mean, in a way, it was ultimately validating of the way that I'm writing, which is just to keep bringing it back to this, you know, yeah, this profound impact of self-admission.
Right.
Yeah.
And even, like, I mean, it's very interesting because even I've had, you know, and it's a fine line as well, you know, when you get caught up in your story, mm-hmm. which you repeat to because you have an addiction to it or because it feeds you energy, and when you can express in a way that is healing. So it is a very fine line because I've had, you know, different people comment on it. And so it is interesting.
Well, I mean, this idea that, you know, and I know having been around a lot of therapeutic group work, you know, that we can go too far with our stories. And I think that's what Byron Katie's trying to say, you know, that we get so tripped out on our story that we don't see ourselves from up high, you know.
Right.
But at the same time, I have some faith that we keep coming back to our story, not as an avoidance technique or because we're so narcissistic, really, but because we know on some intuitive level as humans that there's something in that story that is ultimately what will heal us.
Yes.
That there's some, that it is the grist for the soul mill, that something about that scene with me and that crazy family is the karmic field for my cellular expansion. How will I grow but for that story? I mean, I picked, or it was picked for me, this identification as Jeff Brown. It was no accident. God made no mistake putting me in human form in that family. But I think people keep coming back because they don't have tools in a society for how to take that emotional material, the school of hard knocks, and convert it into the lessons that it inherently contains, you mm-hmm. know? And I think that's the problem. As therapists and as a culture, we don't really know how to hold the space for process all the way through to lesson being learned. So we open the door, we talk about the issue, and then we go back to work and readapt. You know, what that person needed was 7 days in a retreat center to really work through that trauma or that something less than trauma to kind of transform their consciousness and reintegrate and then come back out into the world at a different stage in their development. And that's what we haven't set up yet in society. I mean, I would love to have a foam cube in my house where I can take pictures of people I'm angry at and shred them, you know, with a Wilson baseball bat. It's fantastic. But I think we need them on every corner. I think we just need to invite this out. Just get it on out, get freshness of appreciation every time, move it on out, you know. Don't subvert it, don't say emotions are an illusion, you know, absolutely getting spun out in the same incomplete and unexpressed emotion forever halfway through it is terrible. Let's encourage people to get it all the way out. Mm-hmm. And then that's how they'll grow, you know. I mean, that's the only way I've ever really feel like I've grown, is when I was able to see a process all the way through to the end.
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting thought. And I wonder sometimes, and maybe this is, again, this delusion between, you know, the differences between men and women. I mean, women usually, and I think it's for everybody, I mean, usually underneath anger is sadness, but women Yep. seem to have, you know, and I don't know if they, you know, it's bad to be angry, so don't be angry, but they get into their sadness and then they can express that way. But for men, it's like yeah. you've got to really get into your anger.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's because, again, women are so programmed not to express anger.
Yeah, well, I think men are programmed to not express anything, actually. I mean, I feel like women come closer to the emotional bone. You know, when it comes to, well, we know this, but when it comes to most situations, like maybe they don't fully experience the anger piece because that's taboo and all that, but at least like in getting into the grief, they're getting into the heart of the matter a bit. Mm-hmm. I think for most men, and certainly most men I know, they don't get into any of it. You know, they don't get into any of the anger. They don't, I mean, maybe in some weird drunken fit of rage where they beat up a guy in a bar who has nothing to do with the person that wounded them at the age of 8, you know?
Mm-hmm.
To me, it feels like, you know, that whole area is so, emotional regions are so taboo and foreign and uncomfortable. I had a dialogue last week with a relative of mine, a guy who's really blocked up. And, you know, he knows that he's blocked up. And, you know, I was talking to him about, like, he was talking about a situation. It was clear it was bothering him, you know. And it was, like, trying to get to, like, you know, what are you feeling about it? And he kept saying, I think. So right away, you know, he doesn't. And it was, like, there was just no way. And I just sat there, I thought, you know, he just really does not have the language and is so uncomfortable with the terrain. You know, it's like a mountain he's never climbed.
Yeah.
He doesn't think he's allowed to climb it for some reason. He's been so conditioned or so somehow so obstructed or so armored on a deep level that he can't access it. And, you know, I mean, I think we're in trouble. You know, I mean, I think we're in trouble as a species because I really think that men are not keeping pace developmentally with the stuff that's going on for women. They go in their minds and do consciousness mind trip. I know a lot of male meditators, you know. But when you really start, you know, talking about getting into the emotional body, feeling the heat of the heart, you know, Yeah,
it's an interesting time because I think, you know, so many of us are becoming aware of it. So many others are trying to, you know, say how unimportant it is because they're not willing to do it.
Well, the spiritual bypasser movement is very strong right
huge.
Now. The detachment trip, all those people who are trying to get away from their pain bodies because they don't know how to work them through. So instead of admitting, hey, I don't know how to work them through, so I'm getting out of here, they present, they create a model of enlightenment, which includes emotions as illusion, ego as illusion, you know, no emphasis on the healthy self-concept. I mean, how, you know, talking about shame, this is really important, how confusing is it for people now? For many years in the West, we were talking about building the self-concept, self-esteem, you know, feeling good about yourself,
right?
You know, and how that links into having a more spirited or, say, spiritual life. And now we've got this misconstrued, misinterpreted, one-sided, imbalanced Eastern message, which is that, you know, we're really all one. There is no self. It's like hysterical. It was like now all of a sudden, like you're all mixed up with like, I feel fantastic. I'm a good writer. I can finally admit I'm a good writer. And then it's like, hey, dude, please be humble. You're nothing. You're everything. You know, it's like, who are you kidding? Right? And it's like, how confusing is this? This really odd time before we have bridged the wisdom of the West, the emphasis on a healthy self-concept and emotional healing, the wisdom of the East, the quest for essence, unity, consciousness, all oneness. We have not woven these together now.
Yeah.
We're really like attaching to models that are either super Western and psychoanalytic or super Eastern and like get out of ego, all ego is bad, get out of the emotional body, get out of the pain body, all that nonsense. And really, I think if soul shaping is anything, I know other people are starting to talk more about this now, we need an inclusive model that understands the importance of a healthy self-concept on this path. I mean, you got to like yourself if you're going to believe there's magnificence living inside of you.
Hmm.
I mean, otherwise, the idea of divine purpose, you know, what does that mean exactly? You know, what do we do with, I have a particularly relevant role in the heart of this unified field of perception. That is that we are all part of it together. I'm not alone in this. I am connected to other. You reflect me, I reflect you. But what happens with the idea of individual path, people coming with particular gifts and callings that they're here to manifest, you know? And I think this directly relates to the question of shame. You know, because if the message is that you don't have a self, your self isn't valuable, your ego, every part of it is this horrible enemy of the sacred, how are you going to get out of the shame trip and just feel empowered?
Yeah.
And I think that's why we're real mixed up right now in the West. We're importing the East, and it's just, I think this, we've got to find a way to hold all of these truths at once, to hold the idea that, you know, a healthy ego is fantastic and maybe ultimately is indistinguishable from the soul.
Right.
You know, does the state of the ego not reflect the shape of the soul at its stage of development? I mean, these are all kind of questions I think about, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, what are we going to do with the ego in relation to this question of shame? You know?
Yeah, and what is the role really of the ego? Is it to help us, or is it, you know, is it not here to assist us in our individuated aspect of God? Like, is it not here because it is part of who we are on this planet to assist us to heal those aspects that we are wanting to heal?
Yeah, and what do we even mean by ego? I mean, you know, I mean, including myself, throwing this word around and somehow avoiding defining it, you know. I mean, are we even talking about the same things? I mean, you know, people, anytime you have a sense of self, people call it egoic or something. And it's like, well, and if you have a healthy sense of self, is that the healthy ego? And if you have this kind of imbalanced sense of self, you know, self-deprecating sense of self, you know, superior sense of self, is that the unhealthy ego? I mean, is it all the ego? And we don't have to answer this question tonight, but I mean, I think these are the questions we need to ask, and they directly interface with the question of shame.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I mean, I remember talking with somebody who was doing a big talk, and I was doing a radio show with her, and she, you know, she was talking about the soul and how, you know, she's, you know, moving into oneness, and then she has this soul that still seems to have some issues. And I said, well, isn't it because our soul is the individuated aspect of God? It is the bridge to God, but it's still what holds all of our memories from all of our past lives. I mean, it's still the aspect that bridges us in this physical form. So it's still individuated. It's not, mm-hmm. you know, it has memories. It has, because yeah. you can connect in with it.
Absolutely.
So in that sense, the soul and the personality and the ego, I mean, they all play it's all one. I mean, it's all part of the same process of who we are.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. It's like, let's say if you accept this idea that that the soul travels from lifetime to lifetime, and I do. So let's just for the moment. So then for me, it's like I have this idea in soul shaping that we have soul scriptures. You know, we come in with particular key callings, lessons, archetypal pathways, key connections that we're here to learn from, and in learning from them and in manifesting them, we move our soul one step closer to wholeness. So let's say for me, writing Soul Shaping was part of that.
Absolutely.
Know? Like I had to write that book.
Absolutely.
I did. I mean, I was insane if I didn't write it. I couldn't sleep. I had to write it. So how would I have written that book without a part of my ego that was strong enough and, you know, confident enough and certain enough to believe and to push me willfully through to complete that process? You know, how could I possibly, in other words, do my soul's bidding or honor my soul's journey without a part of my ego that mm-hmm. was healthy, you know? And I know that the love that I got from my grandparents, who served in great contrast to my mother and my father, that I remember so often I felt like I was riding that energy on an egoic level in order to finish that book. You know, I kept going back to their love, you know, in my bones, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I just felt like this ego is fantastic. And even if you feel as though it ultimately is not going to be part, like if you become Brahman, if you become whole, the ego dissipates, all this stuff, right? Even if you accept that, you got to accept also that to get to that stage, your ego is fundamental to the process. Even if it reflects the most toxic parts of your developmental journey, you are here to grow through that and get to the next place.
Mm-hmm.
It has got to be embraced. And to me, this is all part of the spiritual bypass movement, which is separating out from the ego, separating out from the shadow, separating out from negative emotions. You know, everything is unreal except what? All oneness? I mean, don't you need somebody to come home to? No, really. I mean, don't you literally need a physical form temple to come home to? Something to identify as self, a karmic vehicle that you move through the trailways of transformation on? Really? And, you know, so to me, it's like honor the healthy ego and even understand that the unhealthy ego, you know, carries the remnants of that which you're here to work through. In either way, it's completely essential to your process.
Right. And, you know, this whole talk about enlightenment, I think it's really, I think it's starting to become more defined as what it truly means. I think in the past, it's been this elusive, you know, oneness thing that I really...
Bliss trip.
Yeah, that I don't think is in any way the reality of what it is.
No, I mean, does Eckhart Tolle look blissed out to you?
Well, I'm not quite sure he's enlightened, but
yeah.
But yes,
well,
no.
Right. And not to only identify Eckhart in this way. I mean, this is, you know, in my work, even in my most purified moments, I don't feel enlightened. I mean, I talk about enrealment in the book because for me, the most spiritual person is the one who's in the greatest number or greatest elements of reality at one time, you know, who is really just here in every sense, not just in the places that are comfortable, but who's here in the material, in the physical, in the emotional. All the bodies are uniting and ultimately weaving together, you know, what I call Western consciousness, right? That's enrealment, and that's all I'm after, because the more work I do, the clearer I get as to my path and why I'm here, my sacred purpose, the more genuine I become. And that means I have more access, like as a child, to all those negative and shadowy emotions. Maybe I'm having a bad day, and that's the truth. It doesn't feel unenlightened to have a shitty day.
Right.
You know, I think that other way of characterizing enlightenment, and there are healthier ways of characterizing it historically, it really was put forth by people who just wanted to feel good all the time. You know, and you can't feel good all the time. You can't be in a human body and feel good all the time.
Not and be authentic, yeah.
No, it's just not real.
Yeah, because there's too much going on around us to not be affected by it. And
yeah, I think that absolutely, you know, or you just have a stomachache, you know.
Are you sure enlightened people have stomach aches?
If we keep questing for authenticity in everything that we do, transparency, be self-revealing, you know, own our path is important, you know, work through the shame pieces, just more and more authentic, I think we're going to have as close to what they're calling an enlightened planet as possible, right?
Mm-hmm.
Without it being defined in quite that way. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, authenticity, I said, truth is the gateway to the moment, you know. I mean, that I feel more real and more present and more connected to oneness when I am living in an emotionally truthful way than at any other time.
Yeah, and I think it has a lot to do with, like, this full body presence, full body awareness, where, you know, there are so many areas in our lives where we're terrified to get in our bodies. There's so many spiritual people out there that don't even know what it would be like to be in their bodies.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's really where we have to go. And I think that's the only way we get to face all of our shame.
Embodiment. Well, that's all in the body. It's in the bones of the being. Absolutely. You know, the emotional body and the physical body, they're the temple, and they are the karmic field for the soul's lessons. It's really, really, really true. It's all in here, you know. I don't understand the seeing it outside of the. I don't identify with that, and I don't have an experiential basis for that, of understanding how my soul lives outside of my body. I don't understand. You know, my soul comes right through my bloody heart. I mean, that's just always the way it's been. The more I open this heart, the more I tell the truth, the more my heart opens, and the more I feel connected to my soul and to unity consciousness at the same time. You know, to me, it's not about waking up. It is about waking down. You know, and I know there's a whole waking down movement I've just found out about out there, and that's what it is, you know. But waking it all down, not waking it down like doing kirtan, and I'm waking it down because I'm trying to get enough energy to rev up so I can go back to God outside my body.
Right.
But waking it down so that I use, for example, the sound vibration to chisel away at the armor that I'm holding internally and wake that emotional body up, and through that emotional body as vehicle, connect to God. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I know we've sort of talked about this a bit, but, you know, I think our sexual energy is one of those areas that, you know, we hold a lot of shame, and I think
Absolutely.
It's because we're such a sexually repressed society
Yep.
that, you know, that full body embodiment is, you know, an area that most women are terrified of, if not most men.
Yeah.
They want it, but they're not there.
Yeah. It's so powerful. Well, I think so few of us really, you know, ever take a ride on what I call the heart genital highway, you know. I think that the connection between the heart and the genitals is so obstructed for so many of us. And
oh, you almost made me choke on my tea there. Sorry.
You choked on your tea?
Yes, because you come up with the greatest sayings.
Well, I'm crazy.
You are.
Yeah, but it's crazy in a good way.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no, but really, I think that this is so inextricably linked to this, you know.
I think it is.
That really it's not all connected. It's safer to keep it, you know, separate or something. And, you know, it has a lot to do. And that perpetuates the shame cycle, you know. I mean, if we could really get in our sexuality, connect to our hearts, you know, even as men, be really vulnerable in the sex act, you know. I remember I have a good friend of mine. He got involved with a woman. He was very, really, really connected. And he would start crying sometimes during this really emotional sexual experience he was having. And I've had this experience as well. And I remember when he first told me that, even though I had had this experience in my life, I remember thinking, dude, you're crying while you're having sex?
Nice.
What is wrong with you? You're not a man, you know? And I was semi-conscious, you know? It was like, wow, it's so deep in us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting area because I think, you know, as the goddess sort of wakes up, and she's been waking up for a while now, but as she wakes up, I mean, she's really taking over women in a way that they're not really accustomed to, and in a way that, you know, history hasn't really remembered.
Well, and the other problem is, because I think women can handle that power, is that they're not...
Well, I certainly can, but...
Yeah, I believe you. But they're not being met in that place by men, you know.
Right.
You know, there's this powerful female energy, sexual energy, you know, women understanding the power of their sexuality and their right to express it, and then we're, you know, all charged up with no place to go, right? Because men, I think we just haven't figured out yet how to meet that energy and still, and maybe shame has a lot to do with it. You know, maybe there is this, you know, frightened response almost as though it's like, whoa, I thought I was the power here. Mm. I might need to be the power here, you know? What to do with all that energy? You know, how do I worship that and at the same time take myself seriously? I mean, I don't know. I just think we just haven't looked at in the eyes and been able to sort of sustain ourselves. I mean, it's, you know, I remember being like a young sexual guy in my 20s and would meet like a powerful sexed up woman, and it was like, whoa, you know, I was like intimidated by that. You know, I preferred the more vulnerable female. I preferred the newbie who was new at it, you know, and like, what's that really about? Like, where does that preference come from inside of us, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's one of those taboo areas that I think, you know, we're just really coming into and trying to understand it ourselves. Like, I think it's just so different. And, you know, there are a lot of tantra people out there, and, you know, that certainly touches on the sacred sexuality, but it's also been very, westernized.
Mm-hmm. And, well, I don't know. I think conscious sexuality, you know, I think it's in many ways, it's no different than having repressed the personality, having repressed so many fundamental, authentic parts of ourselves, putting on ties, kind of, you know, getting away from animal. It was almost as though, you know, we had to corral or contain the wild beast that was the body, because for so many centuries, it was violent, it was abusive, it was a male rapist, you know, it was murderers, it was horrible things. And now we're getting kind of something called civilized. Mm. And so, like, we maybe went too far, you know, and maybe what we need to do now is start coming back out into the embodiment experience, into the animal, but in a more conscious way, in a more civilized way, right?
Yeah.
So a more civilized, conscious form of expressing our sexuality that isn't as frightening to people because, you know, I mean, God, I feel like 50% or 60% of the women that I've known have been sexually abused by men in their lives, you know, actively sexually abused by men in their lives. And, you know, I mean, I wonder if we're just not really ready yet to begin to experience sacred sexuality in a way that's non-threatening.
Well, gee, I hope that's not the case. But, you know, I think it's just so new right now. Like, we really are redefining, you know, what a woman is, because it's been so repressed for so long. And of course, we come in many different packages. So we're all so very different.
Right. Right.
But shame, I think, plays the biggest role in all of our development, because it's what, you know, holds us back from being who we want to be.
Absolutely. Droplets of shame get behind our eyes, and we absolutely can't see what's possible. I mean, that's absolutely true in every area of our lives, you know. I mean, I don't even, you know, I was trying to imagine at some point writing a book, like a vision of an actualized society. If anyone out there is a writer, this is, I think, would be a wonderful book to try to envision how people would talk, how they would interface, how they would live, how they would breathe, how would they, everything. And I realized, you know, it was like I would read Jean Houston stuff and Maslow stuff and even Ken Wilber stuff and just try to imagine what would a heightened consciousness community really look like, you know, and act like. And on an individual level, how would we live in our bodies? And I realized I didn't know.
Yeah.
You know, I really didn't know how I would portray that really in a way that was real, because it felt like it was, we're so over-adapted to our usual habitual ways of being anyway, but it felt like we're so far away from that. And not to be pessimistic, because I think we're moving toward it, but I really don't have any idea. You know, I mean, I imagine we'd be more creative, we'd be more artful, we'd definitely be linking our sexuality to our emotionality and our heart, and, you know, we'd be doing all of that, and we'd be real free in that and expressive in that, but I don't know, do you have a vision of possibility for how we would look if we could reach a more actualized stage as a culture?
Well, what I think is interesting is that as you talked about that, it brings up memories of people that have spoken saying they're from advanced races and advanced planets, and all of them talking about the fact that they no longer have an emotional body, that they all have gotten rid of that. And I mean, that would be really sad.
Well, yeah, but that, you know, were these human beings that said
that? Well, see, this is it. That usually it's somebody being channeled,
channeled by, right. Well, maybe they are, or maybe they're just some very complicated spiritual bypass or dance of imaginary channeling, you know.
Yeah.
Maslow said, which I think it was Maslow, it might have been Jean Houston, I think it was Maslow, he said, an actualized person is an ordinary person with less taken away. I think it's always very interesting. It was like, you know, it was celebrating the idea that we're all fundamentally, in our essence, actually actualized or capable of living in that way. We just got to work through the obstructions in the society to be that being, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think of children in that, you know, they can express their anger in like two seconds and then, you know, be joyful the next. And that would be kind of the way we would want to be in our lives, that, you know, if that's authentic, if we're moving towards an authentic place, then we would want to be able to express it without hurting, without, well, again, like that's all shame that comes through when we start thinking about those possibilities. But, you know,
well, you know, it's funny, I just thought of something when you said that. You know, through my early life, I tantrumed all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it was my quest for an authentic existence. I was trying to move the negativity and the suffering of the environment and the abuse I was receiving out of me so I could come back to freshness, right?
Mm-hmm.
My two brothers, the message was communicated to them, don't be like your brother, which they probably interpreted as, partly as, don't be as wildly emotional as him. And both of them became quite repressed. One kind of played Dungeons and Dragons and kind of left his body in that way, always with littler kids he hung out with. And the other one kind of just sucked his thumb and watched TV and just turned off the emotional tap, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Those tantrums saved me. One of my brothers is now a crack cocaine addict. The other brother is basically paranoid and just doesn't leave the house and hasn't really worked in the workforce forever, you know? And then I go off and do my thing, you know? And I think that really what it was is that I kept, even though the message was, don't tantrum, they took me to Clark Institute in Toronto. We had family meetings, you know, they tested my IQ, you know, all this business. But that really, I think what saved me, and I think Alexander Lowen and Bioenergetics, they were quite right about this, was the tantrum. You know, it was like tantruming my way to God, right? I kept coming back to the moment because I cleared all that debris out of my system. Not that I haven't accumulated some since, but I did that in my very early life, you know, really kind of courageously, I now understand it. And And the message was, don't tantrum, you're crazy, you're creating a ruckus, and you're 100% right, you know. By communicating my authentic emotional experience, I think it's what saved me. Yeah,
it makes me think of different times. I mean, my mother was the only person that I could rage out against. I don't know why, but and those moments were the only times, and as I was in my teens, that I was able to express that kind of frustration and anger.
Right. Right. Lucky for you.
I don't think she thought so, but yes.
Yeah, of course. Well, of course, you know, they want order. I mean, that's the whole thing, but yeah, I mean, that's the chaotic magnificence of emotional authenticity. It may look ugly, but, you know, if you really see it all the way through, right, it's the difference between a kind of repressed nervous breakdown where you only open up the can of worms and never see it through, and a breakthrough when you actually transform your consciousness through that process of genuine expression.
Yeah,
so I think you're right. Children have to be encouraged, you know. Why not get a little foam cube in every house, so when they're mad, they can just, you know, bang it.
Right.
With a little rubber bat. You know, and then they learn something called appropriate release, you know.
Right.
It's like, okay, I'm angry, and I'm going to contextualize it. I'm going to focus on who I'm angry at, and you're going to say verbally, I'm angry at you, whatever. And they really learn to understand, don't take it out on the wrong person.
Right.
You know, something we're never taught.
Yeah. Yeah, because we all take it out on the wrong person.
Yeah,
all
projection,
of
projection, projection, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, when you see the parent, the child who's running across the road, and the parent goes to pick him up and starts, like, yelling and screaming and, you know, beating up on the kid because
they had a hard day.
Well, because the kid's running across the street and they're terrified that the kid, something's going to happen to him. So
Right. They,
you know, instead of grabbing them and hugging them and, Right. You know, doing what they really want to do, they you know, vent on them.
So instead of getting hit by a car, they get hit by their...
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just amazing how much we project our fear and our pain in a way that's just so unproductive.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about shame. I mean, it's really, those are the areas that we... And it's why we do these things.
Yeah.
We don't have that outlet. We don't understand shame enough and what it does to us to be aware of it. Because how do you express shame?
You mean how does it manifest?
Well, how do you express it in a healthy way?
Right. Well, you start talking about it. I feel ashamed of myself.
Yeah.
I feel, you know, invalid. I feel like I'm not entitled to be in this body sack on this planet at this time. Really talk about it. How does it feel to talk about it?
Right.
You know, really, like, feel it. You know, maybe that's, I mean, not to get drenched in it, not to, you know, get drowned in it, but express it, you know. I really, you know, what a thing. You know, and that's what I felt last week. It was like I really felt that. It was like I felt like I really wasn't entitled to be here. All this work I'm trying to do in the world to help, I felt like, you know, it was like I was beating myself. Like, you're a fraud, Jeff, you know. Like, who are you kidding? You know, like, this is the internalization of that message, you know? And then I went to the mirror at some point along the way, and I played with the languaging of, as mantra, right?
Mm-hmm.
I love myself, you know? And just like, you just keep saying, I love myself, I love myself. Just see what comes up, and not that you're necessarily going to believe it at all. But then, like, why don't we, you know? It's like, don't we want to reach a stage where we really love ourselves, not love ourselves in a really imbalanced narcissistic way that we think we have more value than everyone else. Forget that. Not a superiority trip.
Right.
Just simply an I love and value you. Like, touch your body, you know. Say, I love you, body, you know. And use that as a practice and see what comes up that's contrary to that message, and keep doing the work until you reach the point where you do that. And you absolutely feel it. And I definitely don't absolutely feel it most of the time. So, I mean, this is, you know, I'm not speaking like I figured it all out, but I think this is a wonderful way to work it, you know,
mm-hmm.
to begin to see that which is not self-love, you know, which is so often shame, and then work towards a more self-loving way.
Right. Yeah. It's just an interesting topic because, you know, we're really not... I mean, most of our emotions are not expressed in a healthy way, but shame is, you know, shame is an area that we just don't even understand.
I think that's it. I think it's even thinking today about how to talk about it, it feels so insidious that, you know, and we try to find something clarified to say about it, but I think that really we have a lot of work to do before we can even begin to understand, because it affects our perception of the moment. It affects everything, you know. If we just don't understand the vastness of this being that we are, we don't understand how magnificent and relevant our birth is. We don't understand, you know, we say like, you know, we get this like these like spiritual aphorisms out there, affirmations, you know, about how important, you know, everybody's important, everyone has value, everyone, you know, it's like, yeah, whatever. I mean, until you feel it, it doesn't mean anything. And, you know, but I do know on some deep intuitive level that that's just true, that the kind of stuff that Maslow was talking about, or what Jean Houston sees through her eyes when she looks out at the world in terms of what's possible, is truly right on. We are magnificent. I mean, we may use 1/1000th of our magnificence. Imagine. Oh, can't even imagine. But what a thing to try to imagine, you know, what it would look like if we could just embody all of that freely, you know? And that's the work, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's your work, and I think feel like that's my work, to try to remind people that that lives inside of them and to invite them in the direction of it. And, but still not in some simple, clarified way, because, you know, I'm struggling with the same question all the time, you know.
Yeah.
You know, how seriously can I take myself before the monster of shame shows up and says, dude, who are you kidding? You know, what could I accomplish without him showing up? You know, how many other books could I write? How far can I go? You know, I mean, I'd like to find out.
Right.
I really would. Yeah.
I think we all would.
Yeah.
Just you, though. Just for you. We all want to find out what it would be like for you to find it.
Yeah, but, you know, all of us to just,
yeah.
I mean, really, I mean, if our lives were just about excavating and honoring our divine purpose, all of us, if that's what we cared about the most, I mean, God, I just, what a beautiful world.
Yeah. Yeah, as long as we weren't asking everybody else. What it is that we're actually trying to figure it out ourselves.
No, but really make this the first priority, the first order of business, the thing we're taught about in school.
Wouldn't that be great?
In grade three, you learn how to write, you learn how to do things, and then you have a little, you spend 3 months talking about something called, you know, divine purpose. Wow. It's going to happen.
You think?
I hope so.
Oh,
I do. I have every faith in humanity. I believe it will happen. Yeah. Yeah.
In this lifetime, or...
No, probably not, although probably in some select places.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fascinating. Mm. So you've been doing a lot of stuff, Mr. Brown.
Yeah, lots going on.
Lots going on. Did you want to talk about anything?
You know, I don't know. I was writing some inspirations for Good Morning America.
Mm-hmm.
I'm excited about those. You know, I had word limits, so I had to really, like, get real concise.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm an over-talker, so that's always good. I have a little piece I'm going to write for the Washington Post that's due in a few weeks. I'm excited. I'm excited about soul shaping, moving in a, being accepted in a more mainstream way. That's a sign that we really are waking up, or waking down, as it were.
Waking
and
down.
I'm excited about that. And yeah, you know, we're finishing the movie. I'm making this film, Carmageddon, about my connection to Bhagavan Das, including Ram Das is in it, and Sean Korn and other people, and it's getting real good. I'm really excited about it, and it really conveys a message that's very similar to soul shaping in terms of grounded spirituality and weaving the East and the West and all the rest of it. So,
nice.
I'm excited about that.
Yeah. Nice.
Like that.
You were talking at one point about a new book. Is that...
Yeah, I keep wanting to start a love story.
I know.
But I'm selling the house, and I feel like this is important to get out of Toronto. And
oh, you're going to leave Toronto?
Yeah, I'm going to move just outside Toronto, I think, to the country. And I'm thinking very seriously about doing a 4 to 6 month soul-shaping bus tour, either starting in October or in January, and traveling around North America and doing workshops and talks and book signings. And
Nice.
And filming it like a doc, and you know, really trying to move the energy, and you know, and film it talking to people about divine purpose. And everyone has a story. It's amazing when you talk to anyone, you know, about what job they're doing and whatever relationship they're in, and like, you know, other glimpses they've had of other pathways of possibility along the way. I find that fascinating, really.
Yeah.
So I'd like to weave that into the bus tour.
That would be fun.
Yeah. So I'm looking for a bus.
Yeah.
I have one contact. I'm going to call them tomorrow. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
And you've painted over your wall, I hear.
I love that back wall so much. And they came yesterday to estimate on the painting. And by the time I came home, we did the deal. And he said, I'm going to do a little patching in the kitchen, and came home and the back wall was painted over.
Wow.
Luckily, my friend Spicy had come and did some beautiful film work, camera work, took some nice shots. So
right.
I'll have some shots. And we have the video on the Soul Shaping channel on YouTube.
Yeah.
Still, what shows it. And I think it's just a message to me, really, that the universe is ready for me to move on to the next stage of the journey. And I've been drenched in this. You know, I did a self-pub edition before the North Atlantic edition, so I've been doing this for a couple of years now. And I think that, you know, they want me to, like, kind of put up or shut up at this point. So they're moving me on out of here, I think. Mm-hmm. So I felt I had a reaction to it, like an attachment thing. And then it was like, you know, it's perfect. I wanted this. I really did.
Yeah.
You know, it's enough already. It's time to start channeling. I'm starting to channel, like, language for the love book, new language. So it's starting to come through me.
Oh, I can't wait to hear those.
I've got one for you.
Oh, do you? Okay.
Well, I don't know. I shouldn't say this on radio. But one of the sections is what you're talking about, kind of how we're never satisfied in a relationship. We want another sexual liaison with someone else. That section is going to be called The Ass is Always Greener on the Other Side. You know, I don't know if I can even get published saying stuff like that. But the ass is always greener on the other side, so they tell me.
You're good enough. Yeah, you're great, Jeff.
Thanks, Laura.
All right. Well, it's been a pleasure, as it always is.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. Anything else? You good?
No, just buy my book.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, come on. And write letters to Oprah.
I mean, right.
Yeah.
Well, you're a little too open and honest for Oprah, I think.
I don't know about that. I think she could. I think if she read that Grassroots book, she would go crazy with resonance. I really do. But, you know, how do I get to her? I had this, like, plan. I was going to find out where she lives. Like, there's this condo in Chicago, and I was going to go in the underground parking there, and I was going to rope a bunch of books down so when they pulled that limo out in the morning, the books would keep whacking against the front window of the car, and she'd reach down and pull the book down.
Right.
But I'd get arrested.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but I am open to suggestions on how I can access her.
Yeah, she is. She's an interesting one.
Absolutely.
Well, I think you will do fine with or without
Oprah.
Oh,
absolutely. I'm not attached to it. I just think it'd be fun.
It would be. It would be. Although,
I think it'd be fun.
A little truthful for Oprah, but, you know, she could use it.
Well, I think soul shaping would be a wonderful contrast to the model that she affixed to with Eckhart. And I think it's important to bring all of these models out in the open, you know, and to talk about them, to talk about their merits and the wisdom of his model, because there is a lot of wisdom to it, and to talk about the wisdom of a more embodied model, you know, and, you know, a model that's more about something I call grounded spirituality, and just start talking about it, you know, and trying to, because all we're trying to do here, get attached to our model, you know, it's just trying to weave together a fabric or a tapestry that is really going to ultimately serve humanity, you know, in moving in more heartfelt directions, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Well, again, it's been a pleasure. I'm sure we'll have you back.
Great.
All right.
Thanks, Lori.
You're welcome.